Welcome to the Netzpolitik TV podcast. My name is Markus Beckedahl and my guest today is Cory Doctorow, science fiction author.
Hiya.
Hi.
You are here on your book reading tour through Germany, and we first talk about your last two books. First is Backup. What is Backup about?
So Backup is a far future novel about a world in which all scarcity has been abolished, and resources are apportioned according to your reputation. So people have kind of embedded computers that know in aggregate how much esteem each person they meet is held in by the people whom they have esteem for. So it's a little like Google's PageRank algorithm. You know, is this person important to me? Well, you don't know them. Is this person important to the people who are important to me? Yes, this person is very highly rated. And so maybe, you know, you could walk into a restaurant and say, well, I want to be the maitre d' now. And you could just stand behind the podium. And if you're important enough to all the people who are coming into the restaurant and the waiters and the chef, you're the maitre d'. It's about fans who've taken over Walt Disney World and are running it according to the way that they think will garner them the most reputation. And it's about a war to see who gets to design the rides. And in the meantime, because they've cured all forms of scarcity, including scarcity of life, they can do things like assassinate each other and then just restore each other from a backup, the way you would recover an old computer from a backup after you dropped it in the bath.
And what are the problems in that society?
Well, the problems are kind of the pure social problems. They're the problems of managing conflicts in will, and they're the problems of any kind of majority-based system, which is that unpopular ideas never get the chance to become popular. It becomes a very winner-take-all kind of society, in the same way that our cash economy has become a winner-take-all kind of society. And so it's very hard for new entrants to get a foothold. And so it becomes kind of a dystopia.
It sounds a bit like a metaphor on the old media system, like TV, for example.
Well, certainly, and a little bit about new media, where, you know, in the old media, of course, you know, you have a very winner-take-all system where you've got, you know, four movie companies, right? There are four record companies, five movie companies. This is crazy, you know, controlling all the media in the world. But even in the new media world, you know, researchers like Clay Shirky have shown that the links between blogs follow what's called a power law curve, where the most popular blogs are twice as popular as the next most popular blogs, which are twice as popular as the next most popular blogs, and so on. And the curve, it looks like this. You know, you have this incredible concentration of popularity and then this long tail tapering off. And Clay, he says that it's because once there are some links to your blog, it's easier for people to find you and make more links to your blog. And so you get this kind of situation where you get very entrenched, where the more power you have, the easier it is to accumulate more power. That's not to say that people can't be disrupted. You know, I remember one day there was a search engine called AltaVista. It's certainly not there anymore. But that rather that the promise of the internet as being sort of flat and democratic might have been overstated.
Okay, is there a happy end in Backup, or do you think with such a society there will be no happy end?
Well, I don't know that it's ever plausible to have a happy end that you know, is the final end. I think that even the world of Backup is a dynamic one where things will change. So even if you achieve some happiness today, you're going to have to do something to maintain it tomorrow. But I think the book actually does end on a pretty happy note where the characters learn to live with what's possible.
Okay. Your second book, which was published in German, is now Upload. I think it is today it reached the stores.
That's right.
What is Upload about?
So Upload is about a cabal of management consultants who conspire with each other to sabotage other groups of management consultants. And the thing that they have in common, the thing that makes one cabal and not the other, is when they're awake. It's about a world in which the thing that becomes important in terms of who you have a loyalty to is who else is online when you're awake and having conversations. Because while the internet is very good at making distance disappear, it magnifies the difference between when you're awake and when you're asleep. It's the difference between showing up on a message board and just being able to read what everyone wrote last night when it was a hot topic, and actually being awake when it's a hot topic. And I think if I'd written the book today, they probably would have been international bankers. You know, they would have been options traders, because certainly those people transcended all geographic loyalty in favor of a kind of tribal loyalty to one another, to the point where they had no regard whatsoever for like real people and what they were doing. So, you know, here in Germany, you had this bizarre circumstance where, you know, the notoriously conservative German central bank threw, you know, shovel loads of money at some, you know, options trader asshole at UBS who you know, threw it into toxic American debt and, you know, crashed the German economy. You know, clearly this is more about tribal loyalty than it is about any kind of national loyalty.
What I think it's funny in that book, I've just read the first 50 books, pages, you use some kind of log files as a dialogue in the book. How do the readers who are not common with IRC chats or something like that react to it?
Well, I guess, you know, science fiction has always contained dialogue of a sort that the reader might not be familiar with. I mean, you know, an old staple of science fiction is people talking with their minds. And so, you know, how is someone who's never been telepathic supposed to understand telepathic dialogue? I guess, you know, science fiction is about introducing the world as though it were an alien place, whether or not it's the real world. And so you can write science fiction about the real world as though it were an alien place, and you can give all the cues to the reader that they need to understand it in the context of the world that they inhabit now, whether or not you're writing about a fictional world or the real world. So you have really good books like Neal Stephenson's System of the World trilogy, his Quicksilver trilogy, excuse me, that write about the 16th century as though it were a science fictional landscape.
I just heard a podcast about the question, is science fiction dead? What do you think about?
No. You know, there are lots of things in science fiction that are dying, for sure. The thing about science fiction is that as a genre, it has reinvented itself in really radical ways and in different media for different purposes since its inception as the scientific romances of the Victorian era. You know, the likes of Victor Hugo and Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, Mary Wollstonecraft, Shelley, and so on. Those writers wrote for a different purpose than the writers of today, and their kind of science fiction is dead. When people say science fiction is dead, they're either talking about one of two things historically. They're either talking about whether or not the predictive capability of science fiction has been outstripped by its by the rapid pace of technological change, which is betrays a really deep misunderstanding of science fiction. It's a misunderstanding that many science fiction writers share, and that's that science fiction is about the future, and at best science fiction is about the present, and almost always it's about the past. You know, when writers are writing about going to the moon in a hot air balloon, they're not talking about going to the moon. They're writing about the new possibilities being opened up by lighter-than-air travel, which had been, up until that point, considered impossible. And they're writing about the way that this represents a turning point in human history, which it did. Going to the moon is just the artistic license needed to make people actually look around at the Zeppelins going by overhead and go, Jesus Christ, the world will never be the same. You know, so at best, these writers are writing about the present. And so their visions of the future reflect their biases of the present. And you can learn a lot more about the present by reading science fiction than you can ever learn about the future. And that's okay, because it's pretty important to know about the present. And the present is not an unimportant subject. So I'm okay with that. The other thing that people are talking about when they say, is science fiction dead, is the traditional audience for printed science fiction has been getting much older. And, you know, when you go to science fiction conventions, it's filled with dwindling numbers of older people. And it used to be that science fiction was filled with young people. And those people are still reading. I mean, they're reading the Harry Potter books, they're reading Scott Westerfeld and other young adult writers, and there's a renaissance, a boom in young adult science fiction. But they're not participating in the kinds of fandom that science fiction has always participated in, but they're participating in other kinds of fandom, mostly online and involving manga and other imported Japanese stuff and gameplay. Excuse me. So there's a lot of cosplayers showing up at conventions like WonderCon, Tokyo Game Show with 250,000 people. I mean, you know, these are giant conventions filled with young people who care about science fiction. They just don't care about the traditions of science fiction of the fandom that has its roots in the 1930s.
Ah, nice theory. Let's come back to your books. You are one of the first authors in Germany who publish their books under a Creative Commons license. Mm-hmm. For me, it's obviously to do it, but normally nobody's doing it. Mm-hmm. What are your reasons?
Well, I mean, it's pretty simple, actually. First of all, my problem as a writer will never be piracy, it's obscurity. You know, of all the people who didn't buy one of my books today, most of them did so because they never heard of it, not because someone gave them a free electronic copy. And secondly, because electronic copies are just not very good substitutes for printed copies for books. And it's not because screens aren't good enough. This is what people sometimes say. They say, oh, someday screens will be better, and then your whole plan goes out the window. The fact is that you and me and everyone we know are already spending 18 hours a day reading off a screen. If screens weren't good enough, we would be complaining about it more. The thing that computers aren't very good at is allowing us to concentrate on one thing for more than 10 minutes. You know, anytime you sit down to do anything for more than 10 minutes at a computer, your email starts bouncing. Or, you know, you remember that you haven't done your banking and you realize that you can just pop over there in your browser. Or you think of something you want to look up on Wikipedia. Or you get an IM or something comes in your RSS feed. And the fact is people just don't do stuff that requires sustained focus and attention on computers. And that problem is not getting better, it's getting worse. Much, much worse, because the internet is getting much more interesting. So, you know, on the one hand, giving books away for free helps people find them, and on the other hand, people don't treat these digital books as substitutes because they can't concentrate on the screen long enough to read them, so they go out and buy the print thing. And then finally, you know, there's this artistic and moral dimension. And the artistic dimension is that we inhabit an era in which anything that can be copied will be. And so if you're making art that's not intended to be copied, it's kind of anachronistic. It's like, I don't know, like making a car with a steam engine in it that's, you know, fired by coal. I mean, yeah, it's kind of interesting, but I'd hardly call it, like, contemporary. You know, it's like retro. So, of course I'm making art that's intended to be copied. You know, the internet's a copying machine. It's not like it's going to get worse at copying in the future. Right? There's my futuristic prediction for you. The internet's not going to get worse at copying. It's not going to get harder to copy stuff forever. Right? Right now, this moment, this is as hard as it's going to get. And tomorrow it's going to be easier, and the day after that it's going to be easier, and the day after that it's going to be easier. For better or for worse, it's just going to get easier. And so, you know, it's artistically satisfying to make art that's intended to be copied. And, it, you know, in terms of the moral dimension, I'd rather, you know, that my audience, who are going to copy this stuff, whether or not I give them my blessing, I'd rather not inhabit a world where I am in the uncomfortable position of condemning my audience for wanting to read my books in the way that they find most salutary, right? That's just, like, crazy, right? Telling your customers that they're idiots is not a good way to earn a living. And it's you know, at the end of the day, if that leads you down the path of, like, suing school children like the record industry is doing, then not only do you sound like a jerk, you are a jerk. So, you know, for all of those reasons and more, of course, I use Creative Commons licenses on my work.
So, is it a successful business model for you, an open business model, or is it just the moral question?
No. Remember those first two points, right? The more my stuff gets copied, the more customers I get. Those customers don't treat electronic books as substitutes. They buy printed books. So, hell yeah, it's great for my pocketbook. But it's this, I live in this, like, amazing confluence where I'm able to do the moral thing, the artistic thing, and the commercial thing, and they're all the same thing. Right? Again, like, this is why Creative Commons is just a no-brainer for me.
Now there shall be the first audiobooks coming out without DRM at Random House. Your books too?
Yeah. In fact, before Random House did that announcement, my agent negotiated a one-off deal with them that said that they would not sell this book with DRM at all. The Random House announcement is that they're going to allow some sellers to sell it without DRM if they choose to. My deal with Random House says that it can only go through retail channels that don't use DRM, so there will be no DRM editions of the book.
Also, is it a German version?
Not yet. We haven't sold the German rights to this book yet. It's the book's called Little Brother, and maybe Heine will pick it up.
So is it a non-derivative license or a share-alike license?
It's a non-derivatives. And in fact, the recording is not under a Creative Commons license because, again, I think that recordings are substitutable. It's just under a no DRM provision with the publisher, and the book itself is under a derivatives allowed license, so you can make your own recordings of the book and share them, and I'm hoping that there'll be fan recordings. I'd love to get to the point with Random House, and maybe we'll be able to get there in the next year or so, where they'll allow a sampling license for the book. So no verbatim copying, only transformative copies, which I think would be great. I mean, that just makes so much sense, right? Like, if you want to take 3 minutes of the audio and make a YouTube video out of it, you know, like, that would be awesome. It just promotes the book. It was a really hard slog to get there with Random House, so I think that, like, you know, as they say in Spanish, poco a poco, you know, a little at a time. But I'd love to get there. I think that's the natural license for audiobooks. Because again, you know, while an electronic edition of a book is not a substitute, an electronic edition of an audiobook actually is a pretty good substitute. Honestly, between the CD and the MP3, I'd rather own the MP3. I'm an audiobook junkie, right? I love audiobooks. But I rip my audiobooks and throw away the CDs. You know, I live in a tiny London apartment. Stacks of CDs are not an asset. They're a liability. You know, if I have too many CDs, I can't find my socks.
The audiobooks will be on MP3, but used with watermarking. From a digital rights perspective, it's better than using DRM, but is it the best way?
I don't know actually if they'll do marking on these, because these are a separate deal, but I know that that's Random House's plan. They did that with eMusic. I think that watermarking's a nice fairy tale, but it doesn't really work. There are two kinds of watermarks, what are called robust and fragile watermarks. A fragile watermark is one that can be removed without damaging the underlying signal. And a robust watermark is one that can't be removed without damaging the underlying signal. In addition to that, there's two kinds of watermarks. There's perceptible and imperceptible watermarks. So an imperceptible watermark can't be perceived by human ear or human eye or human sensory apparatus, only by a machine. And a perceptible one can be. So if you've ever seen a movie that's set at the top, you know, distributed by Lionsgate Films, not for reproduction, that's a perceptible watermark. And it's also robust, right? If you went and you erased those letters, you'd see big holes in the picture. On the other hand, the watermarks that Random House is using for their MP3s, as I understand it, are imperceptible watermarks. They can't be heard by the human ear. Now, from a strictly mathematical perspective, if you are adding no perceptible information to a signal, then by definition, it can be removed without making any perceptible difference to the signal. That is, that's the pure math. That's the signal processing maths of it. So people who believe that they can make a robust watermark that is imperceptible are kidding themselves. This is like making a pregnant lady who's not pregnant. This is like making a slow train that goes fast, right? Perceptible and robust are the opposite of each other. Or rather, imperceptible and robust are the opposite of each other. They literally mean opposite things. Imperceptible means adds nothing to the signal. Robust means cannot be removed without changing the signal. You can't have both, right? It can't be non-fattening and delicious. You have to choose one. So if their strategy is we will identify leakers with watermarks, then I think that strategy won't work, because the instant that they start to actually prosecute people for leaking on the basis of information contained in the watermarks, then people who leak will start to remove watermarks. And removing watermarks is really easy. All you need to do to find the watermark in a file is take two copies of the file and diff them, right? And boom. Out comes the watermark falls out, right? And you know, the signal processing engineers who work for these companies that claim that they have robust imperceptible watermarks, they'll go, oh, you know, you can't find all of our watermarks by diffing them. We have secret stuff. And you say, well, like, so what kind of secret stuff? And they say, oh, if we told you, it wouldn't be a secret anymore. The fact is, if they can't tell you how it works, it's because it's bullshit. Because real security runs on disclosure. There is no security in obscurity. You know, like think back to the war, right? You know, the German Enigma cipher had been broken by Alan Turing. And they were sitting there in Bletchley Park outside of London reading Hitler's love notes to Eva Braun and giggling behind their hands. They knew everything that was going to happen. The Germans thought that they had the smartest mathematicians in the world and that they couldn't make any mistakes. The fact is, the only way to find out whether or not you've made a mistake in your math is to publish it widely and see if any mathematician smarter than you can find any mistakes in it. Otherwise, all you've done is is guarantee that your system is proof against people who are dumber than you. And unless you're the smartest person in the world, your system doesn't work then. Right, so security requires disclosure, and the people who claim to have these robust, imperceptible marks never disclose their technology. Indeed, there was a movement afoot in the American Congress to legislate one of these technologies, something called Veil. And Veil had never been commercially deployed except once. They had a Batman toy, and they had a DVD that went with the Batman toy car, and the DVD emitted imperceptible audio watermarks that would drive the Batman toy around. And on the basis of this, they proposed to use it as a watermarking system to stop all piracy in America. And I talked to a guy who worked for one of the big studios as one of their tech leads, and I said, like, so what evaluation did you do on this? And he said, well, you know, we have all these processes that we go through where we use watermarks, you know, that are used to do just signaling, right? Watermarks are incredibly useful, right? Like if you had a watermark that could be read to determine non-adversarial information, like the name of the artist and stuff, that would replace the ID3 tags if they got lost, that would be really useful. There's no reason that anyone would want to change it to spoil it, and it doesn't need to be robust. It's okay that it's fragile. They use this all the time, right? When they send out stuff from the satellite to all the network affiliates to, like, communicate with them, you know, this show needs to be aired on Sunday at 9 o'clock, all this other junk, they put watermarks in, and sometimes those watermarks get removed not on purpose, but because when they're transformed, when they're transcoded for new pieces of apparatus, those pieces of apparatus transcode them, right? And remove the watermarks accidentally. And he said, so what we did was we took all the stuff that we know removes watermark accidentally, and we put a Veil watermark file through it, and the Veil watermark survived. And I'm like, wait a second, did you actually try this on anything that was designed to remove Veil watermarks? He said, oh no, we don't have one of those. They won't tell us how Veil watermarks work. And I'm like, I think I see a problem in your clever solution here. This is not going to work, right? Because you have never tested it against anything that was designed to remove it. You can't possibly know that it works. So, yeah, watermarks are junk.
Oh, yeah, the other technology is DRM. When Amazon announced their new MP3 market store, all the media said DRM is dead. Mm. Do you say the same?
I like to think it's dying. It's certainly, you know, between, like, Random House Audio ditching DRM, DVD HD folding up its tent and going home. I think we still have to kill DRM on Blu-ray. We still have to kill DRM in Vista, but trusted computing is, like, in free fall. Vista, you know, didn't catch on. Nobody's developing to the security stuff in Vista because it's crap. Apple customers are pissed off that their Apple TV won't play Apple iTunes shows on their high-definition televisions. I mean, you know, the thing about DRM is it's always been about delaying DRM until the public understands what they can do, right? And as soon as the feature is in the market, taking it away with DRM is a non-option. Right, stopping it from emerging with DRM, well, you know, it's hard to get people pissed off about the stuff that they don't know that they're missing. Once it's there, it's very hard to take away. And most of the functionality that DRM seeks to take away is there now. I mean, the people who are developing pan-European DRM for television, the DVB-CPCM, they want to put in shit like, you can only watch this on some screens, or this show can't be watched through a SCART retransmitter. Well, as soon as that, you know, maybe if you don't have a SCART retransmitter and you've never seen a SCART retransmitter and one hasn't been invented yet, then, like, if the first SCART retransmitter in the market requires you to buy SCART retransmitter licensed programs if you want to watch it in your bedroom when it's being played in your living room, then maybe you could, like, actually convince people to buy it. But if people have been regularly retransmitting everything that comes off their satellite dish up into their bedroom without running a wire in for the last 5 years, and all of a sudden they can't anymore, they're going to be pissed. And they're not going to buy your products, and they're going to do stuff like go to these guys, go to the Pirate Bay, and download it without these restrictions on it, because that's the final bulwark against DRM, is if it's not as easy and as good as the stuff you download from the Pirate Bay, then people won't buy it. And the more people there are who know about the Pirate Bay, the harder it's going to be to sell it. And the fact is, every time, like, a government spends money to hook up, like, pensioners to the internet and teach them how to use Google, you teach another generation of people how to type in, like, you know, Rambo 28, torrent, Pirate Bay, download, and to choose not to use DRM, to choose to opt out of the DRM system. And frankly, if they don't kill DRM soon, if they don't get people accustomed to doing the lawful thing, they're just going to lose entirely. The only way to get people accustomed to doing the lawful thing is to adopt practices that make the media at least as attractive as the free media, as the illegitimate or unauthorized media.
Okay, yes, thank you. That was a good ending point. Yeah, and have fun.
Excellent. Thanks, mate. Good to see you again.